This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. C.K. Williams is one of poetry's big guns. He won the National Book Award, the Pulitzer Prize, and served as Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. So it's nothing short of coronation when C.K. Williams calls your work morally serious, poetically authentic, and spiritually discerning. And that is how he described Barbara Rass's first collection, Bite Every Sorrow. Barbara Rass has lived up to those expectations with two more impressive volumes, One Hidden Stuff and The Last Skin. Barbara Rass reads tonight at NC State in Raleigh, but first joins me in the studio to continue our celebration of National Poetry Month. Barbara Rass, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
You published your first book in 1997, which was after what some people would call your midlife.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think of your journey as a poet as a long one?
Yeah, I think it was pretty long. I've completed my MFA in 1975, and I wrote pretty steadily and was sending out manuscripts. And I took a few breaks to have a child and kept writing sporadically and sometimes more intensively. And I just kept building on that manuscript and never really lost the desire to publish and kept sending out. And, you know, it was difficult. A lot of my peers were publishing their work in book form, and though I had published a number of poems and journals and won some small awards, there's nothing like having a book to validate one's work. And lo and behold, when I got the call from the Academy of American Poets, it was a very big deal for me. And at that point, I decided that it was worth waiting for. But it was only in hindsight that I could say that, because it was a long and sometimes lonely road getting to the first book.
Well, did your poetry change a lot from 1975 to that first book in 1975?
Absolutely. In 1975, if I look back at some of the poems I was writing then, I am horrified, embarrassed, and would never want them to see the light of day. And so what happened is that my poetry grew, my confidence grew, and my style changed. And at one point, there was a sea change in which I started writing longer lines. And, you know, I'd like to say that it was on account of C.K. Williams, because I am so much in his debt for recognizing my work. But in fact, my lines just became longer as a part of a desire to say more, and as a desire to embrace more of the world and to really meditate on more of the complexities. And I think my early work was the more typical lyric that inhabits a single moment and perhaps a single subject. And then I became more greedy to include various points of view, memories that spanned different periods of time, and also future speculation. And so my poems really took on a ranginess that I felt attracted to. And I think that that compelled me in a new direction that for me was successful.
That's what maybe turned it around. Would you read a poem for us now? Speaking of memory, maybe Washing the Elephant?
Sure, I'd love to read that. This poem took a long time to write, in that I had two images in mind. One was the image that came to me from a film, an art film I saw that had no dialogue, and so it was difficult to know what was going on in the film. But two young boys were washing a water buffalo, and the water buffalo was painted, and these young boys were washing not the paint off the water buffalo, but washing it in a river all by themselves. So there were these three beings, and it was very mysterious. And then the elephant experience comes at the end, and it's that famous walking of the elephants through the Queens Midtown Tunnel to get them to get them into New York City for the Ringling Brothers Circus at Madison Street Garden, which was the only way they could get them into the city. So this is called Washing the Elephant. Isn't it always the heart that wants to wash the elephant, begging the body to do it with soap and water, a ladder, hands, in tree shade big enough for the vast savannas of your sadness, the strangler fig of your guilt, the cratered full moon's light fueling the windy spooling memory of elephant? What if Father Quinn had said, "Of course you'll recognize your parents in heaven," instead of, "Being one with God will make your mother and father pointless"? That was back when I was young enough to love them absolutely, though still fear for their place in heaven, imagining their souls like sponges full of something resembling street water after rain. Still, my mother sent me every Saturday to confess, to wring the sins out of my small, baffled soul, and I made up lies about lying, disobeying, chewing gum in church, to offer them as carefully as I handed over the knotted handkerchief of coins to the grocer when my mother sent me for a loaf of Wonder, Land O'Lakes, Two Camels. If guilt is the damage of childhood, then Eros is the fall of adolescence, or the fall begins there and never ends, desire after desire parading through a lifetime like the Ringling Brothers elephants made to walk through the Queens Midtown Tunnel and down 34th Street to the Garden. So much of our desire, like their bulky, shadowy walking after midnight, exiled from the wild and destined for a circus with its tawdry gaudiness, its unspoken pathos. It takes more than half a century to figure out who they were, the few real loves of your life, and how much of the rest, the mad breaking heart stickiness, falls away slowly, unnoticed, the way you lose your taste for things, like popsicles, unthinkingly. And though dailiness may have no place for the ones that have etched themselves in the laugh lines and frown lines on the face that's harder and harder to claim as your own, often one love of your life will appear in a dream, arriving with the weight and certitude of an elephant, and it's always the heart that wants to go out and wash the huge mysteriousness of what they meant, those memories that have only memories to feed them and only you to keep them clean.
Washing the Elephant, a poem by Barbara Ross, who is in town today to speak at NC State and read at NC State today, helping us celebrate National Poetry Month. So this idea of memory and of and I love this line. It's so wonderful. I mean, I don't know what poets ever make of this, picking out one line when they've written the whole darn poem. But we have that only memories, let's see, those memories that have only memories to feed them. That our memories live on memories themselves.
Well, of course, because we're the only ones who have them. And if we remember them, we keep them alive. And by thinking them, we elaborate them and sustain them and occasionally remember more. But it's a mysterious thing, the process of memory. And things come and go and occasionally will surprise you.
Well, there's a real suggestion in the poem that the memory has a life of its own if they can feed themselves. And yet, at the end, you say, and only you can keep them clean. And then you make me wonder, well, then who's the me in this you, since I may be an aggregation of memories. I may be a collection of the stuff I put together anyway. So it's a kind of, I won't ask you to answer the question, who am I? although if you've got a minute, you could try. But that's, I think, the wonder of poetry, is that it brings you to those places. And with the skillful use of language and meter and rhythm, I'm brought to new places in my own kind of speculations.
Well, I think it's interesting to answer the question about you, because in this poem, it switches back between addressing the you, which is, in a sense, addressing the self, but also addressing the universal you, which is everyone who is reading the poem. But at the end, I would say that you is both a combination of a common humanity and the person writing the poem.
Yeah, and then this very slippery thing, which is this aggregation of whatever it impulses that is, of chemistry and electronics that go to make up a memory.
Of course.
And how fragile.
A very interesting question, and one that we could talk about for hours, no doubt.
But enough to say that sending us off on the speculation is the great stuff of poetry. And you come back changed, I think. And that's the other thing, is that when you go off on this flight that your poem sends us on, I come back changed. And that, for me, is the power of poetry and language and why anybody should bother to read it. That's mm-hmm. that's my statement, and I'm sticking mm-hmm. to it.
Well, good
but,
for you.
But for you now, over time, let's talk about your confidence and your willingness to stick with it, even though your friends were publishing books and you weren't all this time. I mean, were there points along the way when you're thinking, oh, man, hang it up?
Yes. You know, it's a lonely business, and it's a lonely business for any writer, and least of all, or most of all, for poets who really have not a huge number of rewards. And even poets who are fantastically famous, if you can use that expression in combination with a poet, still have other jobs. And so there isn't the option of becoming a famous writer whose novel is optioned for a film, and then, you know, other things happen and you're translated into a dozen languages and your life becomes both harder and easier. For a poet, it's really a matter of pursuing the craft and pursuing the process for the sake of itself. Right. And, you know, that may bring one to the question of why write?
Why write?
Well, for me, you know, I think it's better than roller skating, for example, and I think it's better than crocheting. And those are things that I did in my early childhood and adolescence. And when I discovered writing, I discovered that this was truly something that was much more rewarding. And I think writing concentrates you in a way that nothing else does. And I'd like to think of it as a form of attention. And Malebranche is famously quoted as saying, "Attention is the natural prayer of the soul." And so I think that writing becomes a way of integrating both, or altogether, the spirit, the emotion, and the intellect. And if it's all working together, then I think one feels truly at the peak of your experience and really the most alive. And on the rarest occasions, you may even feel on fire. But that kind of attention is what focuses the best poems and what's transformative. And there's something really magical about that. And I think Robert Graves nailed it when he said that poetry is a little bit of stored magic.
Are you hoping that same magic, that same sort of sense of burning and being on fire happens for your readers? Is that an expectation of yours that will happen too? That kind of attention?
I think it takes a lot of attentiveness to read poetry and a lot of patience. And I can't say that I hope my readers will be responding in a particular way, only that I hope I reach them somehow and that their response will be varied, because I don't want to project a certain expectation, which isn't to say that, you know, a poem is free game and you can read anything you want into it. But I think that at given time, someone will get one thing and in another time get something else. And one line may jump out at a particular person. I think that what I hope for is to establish a bond of trust with the reader and hopefully some kind of intimacy, and to take that reader to a place that they experience the world with a new perspective. But fire may be a little too ambitious to hope for.
I'm going to take this risk. Can I get you to read It Came Down Ice Last Night? I've got about a minute and a half left. Let's see what happens.
I'm flipping pages. This was an unpredicted request, so I don't have... Ah, how lovely. He has the poem, and it's coming right into my hands. It came down ice last night, and this night now, far from the ire of men, far from the veins of women and their fast elbows, there is lightning in Bolivia. Across the dark water, far from our desperate talk and the lake's obsessive licking, explosions soberly ignite the clouds, and with each flash, the faces we have touched and lost, their eyes mute now in memory. Thunder shakes us like the dreams that build strange architecture in our sleep. White stones, red walls, room after room catching in your throat. Who can handle the constellations in our clear skies that would keep us from bloodying ourselves over and beyond the call of beauty?
Well worth the risk. Barbara Rass, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Barbara Rass' latest collection of poems called Last Skin. She reads tonight at NC State, 7:30 Caldwell Lounge on Hillsborough Street. The reading is free and open to the public. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.